Jodie Foster, I asked you this story the last time we were on the show. But Polly and Samantha, you know, people my age remember this movie.
Yes.
It was you with a lion. There didn't seem to be much safety precautions with you and the lion.
No, I was 9 years old and, I was working with... There were three lions. There was one really old lion with no teeth, and then there was a stunt lion who did all the crazy, like, rawr kind of stuff. And then there was the stand-in lion. So I was working with the stand-in lion, and all I remember is I remember seeing his mane come around, and then he picked me up sideways and shook me in his mouth and turned me around, and every single person on the crew was running in the opposite direction. And I'm like sideways watching everybody, and they took their equipment too.
Several hundred people came together to honor the Marvel Studios crew member who died on set less than 2 weeks ago. J.C. Spike Osorio fell from a catwalk at the Radford Studios and was pronounced dead at the scene.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, through the foreperson, have you reached a verdict?
Yes.
All right, and do you wish to read the verdicts?
We find the defendant, Hannah Gutierrez, guilty of involuntary manslaughter as charged in count one.
Talk to me about how you see AI's impact on the creative class.
I don't know of an industry that will be more impacted than any aspect of media entertainment and creation.
All right, people, let's go.
Welcome to episode 6 of Thousands of Tiny Tyrants, the Mostly Movies podcast. I'm your host, James Harker. If you'd like to contact me with comments or questions, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can email me using the contact form on the About page of my website, tinytyrantspodcast.com. May you live in interesting times is an apocryphal comment most English speakers attribute, some say erroneously, to a Chinese source. Regardless of who wrote or said it, the invocation is understood to be ironic, a curse of sorts, wishing troubled times upon the listener. Well, anyone who works in the motion picture industry has, for 4 years now, been living in very interesting times. No sooner had Hollywood's labor force recovered from the loss of work that was just one consequence of government-mandated COVID-19 lockdowns, and no sooner had producers put behind them the increased costs associated with filming during the pandemic between spring 2020 and autumn 2022, then the dual Writers Guild of America and Screen Actors Guild strikes halted many studio productions from May through the first week of December 2023, six of the prime filming months in North America. During that same COVID-haunted period in October 2021, the world was shocked by the shooting death in New Mexico of cinematographer Helena Hutchins, as well as the related injury of director Joel Souza on the set of the outlaw western Rust. Alec Baldwin, Rust's star and one of the film's producers, accidentally fired a live .45 caliber round into Hutchins and Souza at close range during a rehearsal. The tragedy drew worldwide attention, temporarily anyway, to the safety problems that plague and remain unaddressed in the controlled chaos of gun-obsessed and union member-supervised Hollywood productions on which innumerable on-set injuries and deaths have occurred. Just a few days ago, on March 6th, 2024, a New Mexico jury found Hannah Gutierrez Reed, Rust's armorer and property department assistant, guilty of involuntary manslaughter in Helena Hutchins' death. The verdict was primarily based on prosecutors successfully demonstrating that Gutierrez Reed repeatedly failed to observe or enforce rudimentary gun safety and handling protocols not unique to the movie business, while also failing to execute accepted practices meant to ensure that live ammunition was not present on the Rust set. Anyone who thinks Helena Hutchins' death and the Gutierrez-Reed verdict will lead Hollywood producers, union leaders, and crew to take safety seriously has little or no experience working on film sets. Those same disengaged optimists have probably never heard of camera assistant Sarah Jones, welder Timothy Holcomb, set dresser David Ritchie, stuntman Harry O'Connor, or, just last month, electrician Juan Osorio, to name just a few of the people killed on movie sets during this young century. And I suspect those faithful devotees to progress have never asked what changed on movie and TV sets after the death of Brandon Lee more than 30 years ago, who, like Hutchins, was also killed by a bullet shot from a prop gun. Those same uncritical optimists have probably never heard of or seen the 2006 documentary Who Needs Sleep by the late cinematographer Haskell Wexler. And they probably doubt me when I tell them that anyone who calls attention to safety violations on a movie set might as well just ask to be fired or, at the very least, blacklisted from future work by the union and guild member supervisors who control every aspect of the motion picture production process, many of whom have little patience for suggestions or criticisms from their subordinates.
Jaron Lanier is among the OG Silicon Valley utopians who had grand visions of what the internet could be long before we had PCs, cell phones, or social media.
I think to be an optimist, you have to have the courage to be a fearsome critic. It's the critic who believes things can be better. The critic is the true optimist. The critic is the one who says this can be better, and that means optimism. It's the acquiescence. It's like, no, this is it. Those people are kind of useless.
Speaking of criticism, a team of accountants and financial analysts had some long overdue news for New York taxpayers and Hollywood productions. To help ring in the 2024 new year, but undoubtedly hoping no one would notice, the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance quietly released a study entitled Economic Impact of Tax Incentive Programs, the first in-depth audit of tax credits in New York, including the 20-year-old film production tax credits, which had been introduced by the Empire State in 2004. The study included analysis of both the New York Film Production Tax Credit and the New York Film Post-Production Tax Credit, the handouts from which were increased last year from $420 million to $700 million per year by New York Governor Kathy Hochul. What did the report have to say about New York taxpayers' multi-billion dollar contributions to Hollywood? A headline from New York Public Radio's print outlet, The Gothamist, summed it up pretty well. Quote, state-funded report says New York's $700 million film tax credit is a bust, unquote. The 359-page report was furnished to New York lawmakers by PFM Group Consulting, a company with offices in more than 20 states across the country and whose business provides operations, budget, and other analysis and recommendations to governments and the public sector. John Campbell of The Gothamist covered some of the report's findings. Quote, for every dollar the state gave in tax breaks from 2018 through 2022, the film tax credit drew an estimated 15 cents in direct tax revenue, the analysis found. When adding indirect and induced jobs, employees who don't work directly on production but whose employment stems from it, that return rises to 31 cents, unquote. Bottom line, the study of New York's film tax credits concluded that New York taxpayers lose between 70 cents and 85 cents for every dollar they hand over to the Tinseltown Mafia. To anyone who's been paying attention, the consultants' conclusions were not as interesting as they were predictable. Why do I say that the report's findings were predictable? Because nearly 15 years ago, in December 2010, the nonpartisan Center on Budget and Policy Priorities published a brief analysis and report entitled, quote, State Film Subsidies, Not Much Bang for Too Many Bucks, unquote, that reached similar conclusions, although New York's film subsidies were not a subject of that study. When I brought that 2010 report to the attention of Local 52 IATSE Vice President John Fundis the following year in 2011, the union leader's response was, quote, we don't have to worry about any of that, James. We pay lobbyists in Albany to deal with that stuff, unquote, which is undoubtedly true. And in case you're wondering, John Fundis retired from IATSE in January 2023, a year before the Empire State's damning film incentive report was published. All good things must come to an end, and as the greatest dramatist wrote, truth will out. And in my experience, no amount of money, dishonesty, or corruption, regardless of how passionately applied, will change that. Although initial signs indicate that New York taxpayers will remain on the hook for the state's Dream Factory welfare program, even some of New York's typically pro-union Democrat reps in Albany are calling for reform. Following the release of the tax incentive report, State Senator James Skoufis, who represents New York's Hudson Valley and is the chair of the Senate Investigations and Government Operations Committee, gave a statement reprinted in the Gothamist's coverage. According to Senator Skoufis, quote,
There are some of us, myself included, that believe the film tax credit and the associated entertainment tax credits are such a bad deal that they ought to be repealed. But the politics is the politics in the state legislature, and that continues to remain an uphill climb, unquote. Which, when translated, is precisely what IATSE's John Fundis said to me in 2011. We pay lobbyists in Albany to deal with that stuff. Senator Skoufis was not alone in his criticism of the underperforming tax incentives. State Senator Sean Ryan, who represents the Buffalo area, had this to say on February 12, 2024.
Thank you, Senator Skoufis. Thank you for maintaining your focus over the years on these types of programs. This report lays bare that if New York State was an investment bank, we would be out of business. The independent analysis that was unveiled today, it'll help us identify which of these programs can be considered successful and which can be considered, frankly, a waste of taxpayer dollars. If the program is a money loser and there's no valid explanation, the program should not exist. We should jettison that program.
And while for the first time in a generation, it appears the pipeline of government subsidies for Hollywood might be about to narrow, and as thousands of motion picture technicians and others remain without work following the shutdown of productions by the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikers only a few months ago, last Sunday, on March 3, 2024, two Hollywood unions that represent below-the-line workers conducted a profanity-laced rally in Los Angeles to kick off contract negotiations with the Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers, the AMPTP. The purpose of the rally, which was organized by the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees, aka IATSE, as well as the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Local 399, was ostensibly to psych up those labor organizations' beleaguered and cash-strapped members for another work stoppage. The message these high-salaried union officials seemed to want to deliver to Hollywood studios was, one, that they're, and I quote, desperate, unquote, and two, that they're willing to drop as many F-bombs and bankrupt as many of their members as it takes to show producers that they mean business. Here's the chant with which the IATSE and Teamsters rally began and ended.
And we will tell the motion picture industry, Mike Miller already said it, so now it's going to be a chant. F*** around, find out. F*** around, find out. F*** around, find out. F*** around, find out. All right, let's hope they're not going to f*** around this year. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
If there was any doubt that no sacrifice from their members was too great for these unions, Sean O'Brien, president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, was on hand to clarify that recklessness is definitely on the table.
And now it's my great pleasure to give you the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Sean O'Brien. We got courage and conviction to take on the fight. And I think we all agree that we're desperate. And being desperate is great. Being desperate means that we don't care about consequences for our actions. We don't care about public relations.
I suppose that old school union performance might be an effective warning to the AMPTP. And I can't comment on the mood of the theatrical Teamsters. But anyone who spent time speaking with IATSE members or reading their anonymous posts on social media will probably agree with me that there is very little interest among film technicians in another costly strike. We'll see what happens between now and July 2024 when the current contracts expire. But the most significant and consequential news to hit the motion picture industry in the last few weeks wasn't old-fashioned labor unrest or on-set accidents. Far from it. In fact, this story might, sooner than most of us have dared to imagine, prove the antidote to both of those problems. On February 15, 2024, OpenAI, to the shock even of many people who keep abreast of developments in artificial intelligence, announced and released demonstrations of Sora, that generative AI company's text-to-video model. If you haven't checked out Sora's video output, you won't want to miss it. The videos are stunning, especially considering that the technology is in its infancy. I'll provide a link in the show notes and the tinytyrantspodcast.com website to OpenAI's Sora page. Here's a commenter from the AI Grid,
a YouTube channel and website dedicated to news and developments in artificial intelligence, reading a bit of the introduction directly from OpenAI's Sora page.
Introducing Sora, our text-to-video model. Sora can generate videos up to a minute long while maintaining visual quality and adherence to the user's prompt. And we are also granting access to a number of visual artists, designers, and filmmakers to gain feedback on how to advance the model to be most helpful for our creative professionals. They also state that we're sharing our research progress early to start working with and getting feedback from people outside of OpenAI. Sora is able to generate complex scenes with multiple characters, specific types of motion, and accurate details of the subject and background. The model understands not only what the user has asked for in the prompt, which you can see in the bottom part of the video, but also how those things exist in the physical world. The model has a deep understanding of language, enabling it to accurately interpret prompts and generate compelling characters that express vibrant emotions. Sora can create multiple shots within a single generated video that can accurately persist characters and a visual style.
Now, Sora and text-to-video generation tools like it won't by themselves transform motion picture production. But companies have already begun laying the foundation for AI-driven pre-production, production, and post-production systems. Two of those companies are Morph Studio and Lightrix LTX Studio. I'll include links to those companies' websites in the show notes as well. Morph Studio is an open AI source tool focused, for the time being anyway, on its community of users sharing their creations. And it's worth noting that the company, which currently employs only 10 people, is being financed by Baidu Ventures, a venture capital firm based in Beijing, China. Responses to OpenAI's Sora demos have ranged from, "So what, Hollywood isn't going anywhere," to,
"Hey, maybe you haven't been keeping up on current events, but we just got our asses kicked, pal. This can't be happening, man. This isn't happening."
Well, it's not as bad as all that. Not yet, anyway. But it ain't nothing, either. Reality will turn out to be much more nuanced and entirely unpredictable. What we can be pretty sure of is that a reckoning is coming for Hollywood. Not an apocalypse, but a reckoning, in the form of a new wave of content of a scope and quality that can only be guessed at. A new wave of content competing for viewers' attention and for our money. And anyone considering a career in motion pictures, whether as a producer, an actor, a director, production designer, costumer, or a technician, will do well to think long and hard before walking through the several union member guarded doors that might, if they're lucky, open for them in the near future. Indeed, anyone considering making a career for themselves in motion pictures might consider the possibility that the doors leading to the most creatively satisfying, or the most lucrative, or the most challenging opportunities are only now being constructed. How bad is the news about AI text-to-video advances out of Silicon Valley for workers in Hollywood? Just days after seeing OpenAI's Sora demo, Tyler Perry halted development of an $800 million expansion of his studios in Georgia. Jeffrey Katzenberg, former CEO of Walt Disney Studios and co-founder of DreamWorks Pictures, spoke at the Bloomberg New Economy Forum on November 9, 2023, 3 months before OpenAI even demoed the first iteration of Sora.
I think AI as a creative tool, think of that as a new form, a new paintbrush or a new camera, has so much opportunity around it. I think that it, on the one hand, it will be disruptive and commoditize things that are very inaccessible for artists and storytellers today. You know,
but what kind of things?
Well, the good old days when, you know, I made an animated movie. It took 500 artists 5 years to make a world-class animated movie. I think it won't take 10% of that. Literally, I don't think it will take 10% of that 3 years out from now. Not 10 years
out. But to get the movie out the door.
At the IATSE and Teamsters Union rally in Los Angeles that I mentioned a minute ago, IATSE International President Matt Loeb sounded resigned to the inevitable job cuts and associated savings in labor costs that AI is sure to bring about. So much so that he pleaded with Hollywood studios and streamers to share the savings with the union workers whose jobs aren't eliminated by the technology.
And this may be a little bit of a miracle, but in my mind, artificial intelligence and the efficiencies, which our employers like to call them, which is really money, those advantages need to flow down to the workers. Those advantages need to take pressure off our jobs so we can enjoy our families and live these lives and not have to work 80-hour weeks. If that efficiency comes, it needs to come to us and our jobs, and we will use that to do our jobs better. But we want some of the spoils of artificial intelligence.
I'll take a closer look at what are certain to be the transformative and liberating effects of AI motion picture production in future episodes of Thousands of Tiny Tyrants. I'll also consider how some movie and TV genres may be more susceptible to disruption by AI, as well as how AI might open the door to a revival for artists serious about drama and its unique capacity for exploring intimate relationships and the human condition. But in the meantime, regardless of when AI filmmaking begins in earnest, one thing is certain. AI-driven motion picture production will be safer for everyone involved in the process of filmmaking. Much safer. Just over 4 weeks ago, on February 6, 2024, Juan Spike Osorio, an electrician and member of Local 728 IATSE, died after falling approximately 50 feet from a catwalk at CBS Radford Studios in Los Angeles, where he was working on the set of Marvel's Wonder Man. Early reports have suggested that the accident was the result of a structural failure, but the investigation is ongoing. I had a brief exchange on social media with one of Mr. Osorio's colleagues who seemed to have direct knowledge of what occurred, but he or she didn't want to elaborate, citing the ongoing investigation. I want to commend Madeline Roth and Noor Ibrahim at the Daily Beast for the thorough and sensitive report about Mr. Osorio's life and death, which they published on February 9th. I've included a link to the article in the show notes. The work done by Ms. Roth and Ms. Ibrahim stands out when compared to reports from most other entertainment publishers who, I was disappointed to find, wrote more about the Marvel television series Mr. Osorio was working on, who was starring in it, and when the show is expected to premiere, than they wrote about Juan Osorio. Mr. Osorio's wife spoke at a memorial gathering in his honor on February 18th, 2024.
I know Spike would want all of you to know how much he cared for you. Each and every person that he worked with, each and every person that he knew, he wanted to make sure that they were safe, whether they were in his department or not. He was the most important part of my life, and I appreciate you all and the impact that you all had on him.
After nearly 25 years of working as a union electrician and as a former member of one of the late Mr. Osorio's East Coast sister locals, Local 52 IATSE, I would like to say something about safety on Hollywood sets. I would also like to say something about the empty rhetoric of people like IATSE International President Matthew D. Loeb, whose statement addressing Juan Osorio's death included the following, quote, "Safety on set is our highest priority, and we will assist Cal OSHA in their investigation in any way that we can. If you feel unsafe on set for any reason, members can call the IATSE safety hotline at 844-422-9273 or use our safety info app." Unquote. I'm sorry, but Matt Loeb's statement is a load of malarkey. In Hollywood, the physical safety of the cast and crew are on the list, but above that are getting the shot, making the day, job security, and making work for as many unionized crew members as possible. When you work in the Dream Factory, there is virtually no safety standard that will not be ignored. There is virtually no corner that these unionized filmmakers won't cut. There is virtually no fire code, electrical code, OSHA rule, manufacturer's restriction, or other workplace safety standard that one or another of Hollywood's union and guild member supervisors is not willing to ignore. I don't mean to suggest that efforts are not made by individuals to work safely. Most film crew members endeavor to work as safely as, wait for it, as safely as they've been acculturated to work and to the extent safe work practices are supported by the unionized supervisors who hire them, which is to say, safety is in the eye of the union bosses, not the producers, the union bosses. Because the reality is that someone can walk from one end of a Hollywood movie or television studio or set to the other, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, and never encounter or see someone, excepting perhaps caterers and production assistants, who is not a member of at least one guild or union. Every one of the people directly responsible for the decisions that keep people safe on film sets or whose decisions endanger those men and women is a member of a Hollywood union or guild. And if you doubt that Hollywood's union officials go out of their way to ensure that, to the extent they are able to thwart federal labor laws, every person hired by a production has a union card, don't take my word for it. Listen to the wife of IATSE International President Matthew Loeb in her official capacity as business representative for Local 52 IATSE seem to suggest to an experienced and highly skilled motion picture technician who didn't have a Local 52 union card that, as far as she is concerned, no one is permitted to work without union approval, even someone hired directly by a Hollywood production. And she did this in spite of federal laws barring union officials from threatening or interfering with a non-member's employment.
My name is Mandy Demeski. I'm the business representative at IATSE Local 52. The jurisdiction on the job that you just were hired for. I want to know if you took that job, if you're working on that job, if you're there now, if you've tested for them, because I don't know who you are and you didn't ask to work in my jurisdiction, right? So that's not the way that kind of works. I'm sure you know that. So why don't you please give me a call back so we can make this all go away. 201-280-3477. Okay, again, 201-280-3477. And my favorite color is solidarity. Thank you.
Classy, right? Not quite Martin Scorsese Goodfellas quality, but the lady has, or had, promise. Only a few weeks after the recording you just listened to was made public by entertainment reporter Gene Medeas at Variety.com, Mandy Loeb Demeski resigned in disgrace as Local 52's business representative. I'll put a link in the show notes to the Variety.com article about Demeski. But you can rest assured that the spirit of thuggery and discrimination lives on at IATSE. Because you see, as far as Hollywood's unions and guilds are concerned, not every New Yorker qualified to work in showbiz can be permitted to benefit from the state's $750 million tax incentive. It's up to union officials like Matt Loeb and his wife, as well as union bosses working on set, to decide who may and may not make a living working at the Dream Factory. And these are the same union bosses who get to decide whether or not to put actors, directors, and crew members' lives at risk. Here's an example of senseless and easily avoided tragedy that intersected somewhat with my own work. I mentioned Timothy Holcomb a moment ago. On March 6, 2001, Timothy Holcomb was working as a welder on Spider-Man, Sam Raimi's first outing as director of that franchise. On March 6, 2001, Timothy Holcomb was decapitated when a telescopic handler forklift, also known as a lull or a telehandler, that had been modified by the film crew to function as a crane, toppled over onto the basket of the adjacent telescopic boom lift in which Holcomb and another crew member were working. Holcomb was killed instantly. Footage of the accident is still available on YouTube. Here's a Los Angeles Times report from August 2001 after California officials investigated Tim Holcomb's death. Quote, state officials have fined Sony Pictures $58,805 for five workplace violations stemming from the March death of a crew member on the Downey set of the feature film Spider-Man, a spokesman for the agency said Wednesday. Among the citations issued by the Division of Occupational Safety and Health are a pair of $25,000 fines for modifying a forklift without the manufacturer's approval and without consideration for load capacity. The other penalties were for improper training of a forklift operator, failure to post required operating rules for heavy equipment, and a lack of protective gear for one of the employees, said Cal OSHA spokesman Dean Fryer. Susan Tick, a Sony spokesman, said that Sony deeply regretted the accident and that, quote, the company does all it can on an ongoing basis to ensure that all of our crews on all of our productions follow strict safety procedures, unquote. Tim Holcomb, 45, of Monrovia, died when a forklift modified to be used as a crane fell on him as he and other workers were lifting a 15 by 26 foot metal sign framework to the top of a building facade on the Spider-Man set, unquote. The film crew on Spider-Man were guilty of, quote, modifying a forklift without manufacturer's approval, unquote. Here's the thing. The victim, Timothy Holcomb, as well as every person involved in the decision and act of modifying the telehandler that killed him, were in all likelihood members of an IATSE bargaining unit. Illegal modifications to equipment such as the one that killed Holcomb are done according to the instructions and under the supervision, not of producers or studio executives, but rather according to commands from IATSE department heads who are the film's managers. And these illegal modifications are carried out with the cooperation of these department heads' subordinate union brothers and sisters. Spider-Man's producers didn't decide to modify the forklift that killed Holcomb. Sony Pictures executives didn't show up wearing tool belts and set about modifying that forklift. Every one of the individuals directly responsible for the series of decisions that led to Holcomb's death were, it can be safely assumed, members of one or another motion picture guild or labor union. And it is likely that most of those individuals were members of IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees, whose current president, Matt Loeb, you will recall, robotically declared after electrician Juan Osorio's death that for IATSE, quote, safety on set is our highest priority, unquote. The same Matt Loeb, whose wife implicitly threatened a non-cardholder who dared to accept work in Local 52 IATSE's jurisdiction. And the illegal modifications made to the telehandler that killed welder Tim Holcomb on Spider-Man had surely been made to similar machines dozens of times in the past. And I promise you, those illegal modifications are still being made to telehandlers, aerial lifts, and other equipment on TV and movie sets to this day. How do I know this? I know this because I have watched, been involved in, supervised, and ordered similar illegal modifications to heavy mechanical equipment on film sets hundreds of times. In fact, less than 2 years after joining IATSE, Timothy Holcomb's final film, Spider-Man, was among my earliest union jobs. And on Spider-Man, I was one of many electricians who spent some cold, windy nights in the baskets of aerial lifts, just like the one in which Tim Holcomb died. Indeed, the aerial lift I operated on Spider-Man was itself, as were dozens like it on that movie, modified without the manufacturer's approval to function as a lighting platform, complete with high-voltage cables ratchet strapped to the telescoping steel boom arm and frame of that lift, leaving me, the lift's operator, in what could, in a split second, have become an electrified death trap. And countless iterations of this and other illegal modifications are executed on movie and television sets across the United States every single day. I provided links in the show notes to photos on the Thousands of Tiny Tyrants website of several examples of these illegal equipment modifications on film sets. You might ask whether I know if any of these modified for the movie's death traps have ever harmed anyone, for example, by becoming electrified. Yes, they have. I'll mention just one instance that involved two New York-based movie electricians. After rigging and powering an 18,000-watt, 220-volt metal halide light attached to the basket of an aerial lift, an IATSE electrician, I won't use full names here, Don S., who was standing in the lift, became locked onto the basket's electrified steel frame due to a fault in the cable feeding power to the light. At the time, because the aerial lift was being prepared to, quote, fly, unquote, later that day, Don and the basket were just a foot or so from the ground. Rigging the lift with Don that day was Eric S., a fellow IATSE electrician, and crucially, a trained medical technician or paramedic, I can't recall which. Just seconds after Don's hands gripped the basket's electrified steel frame, which caused his entire body to become part of the high-voltage electrical circuit, rendering him shuddering, immobile, and mute, Eric recognized what was happening, located a junction point in the light's header cable and disconnected it, breaking the electrical circuit and saving Don's life. If Don, or whoever operated that aerial lift later that day, had been alone 60 or 80 or more feet in the air when he or she locked onto the electrified lift basket, they would almost certainly have died. You might ask why labor officials, unionized supervisors, and rank-and-file union members not only tolerate, but more to the point, perpetuate these illegal workplace hazards. After all, couldn't a few enterprising motion picture industry professionals design and demand safe alternatives to those currently in use? The fact is that there already are a few alternatives to the modified aerial lighting platform that almost killed Don S. But there are vanishingly few in existence, and those that do exist are much larger than is commonly called for. Examples are the mobile truck-mounted Musco light and the BB light. The principal reason that these workplace hazards are perpetuated is that illegally modifying, rigging, operating, and then de-rigging and returning the modified machines to their manufactured condition involves thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of work by union members. IATSE and its members won't insist on safe work practices because they'd rather take the money.
Channel 4 News, Lightside, number one in Southern California.
And good evening, everybody. Topping our news tonight, a film producer, Toby Halicki of Gardena, is dead tonight after a stunt went off prematurely on the set of the movie he was filming. The stunt on the set of the movie Gone in 60 Seconds 2, being filmed in Buffalo, involved a tractor trailer ramming cars before colliding with a water tower.
Talking with Chuck Norris, I was doing a scene in this truck, and they put the squibs up by my face. And those things started exploding and started hitting me in the face, and I got cut up and took off a chunk of my nose. And it hit me all around the eye here, went all the way around, and I started bleeding profusely, and I stopped and got out, and you know, and they rushed me to the hospital. And
tragedy, it seems, runs in the family. Bruce Lee was a movie star who died young and became a legend. Now his son Brandon is gone as well, fatally wounded while starring in a movie.
Is too bad, you know.
The thing is, it wasn't supposed to happen.
It absolutely wasn't supposed to happen. I wasn't even supposed to be handling the gun in the scene till we started shooting the scene and the director changed it.
Walking Dead accident halting production on the hit show. ABC's Lindsay Davis is here with the latest details. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, Amy. The Walking Dead is a critically acclaimed horror television series, but it's what happened in real life on the set this week that would best be described as horrific.
The scene for a movie version of Twilight Zone attempted to recreate the terror and the carnage of the hell that was Vietnam. And then, as the crew watched in horror early this morning, the make-believe dissolved and actor Vic Morrow and two Vietnamese children were killed. As David Dow reports, the Twilight Zone became a nightmare.
Because the subject of safety is so important, I want to mention, as I recollect them, a few more on-set disasters and near disasters that I've witnessed over the last 30 years. In 1999, on the last night of principal photography for Pollock, the biopic directed by and starring Ed Harris about abstract painter Jackson Pollock, I was one of dozens of crew members who watched Harris's stunt double recreate, to our horror, almost to the last detail, Jackson Pollock's 1956 death in an automobile accident. The, ironically, unmodified Oldsmobile 88 with its convertible top down driven by the stuntman was airborne and careening toward a stand of trees after taking off from a low stunt ramp in a Long Island park. As the car ascended, it continued to roll, and as it disappeared into the wooded darkness, it appeared to everyone watching that the car, which did not have a roll cage or added structural protection for the stunt driver, would certainly land upside down. One crashing sound was quickly followed by another. The cameras continued to roll. The panicked stunt coordinator ran into the frame towards the woods while the camera continued rolling, followed quickly by Ed Harris's acting coach, in response to which Harris screamed, "Get the f*** out of my frame!" sending the only two people with sense enough to want to help the stuntman running back away from the accident and out of Ed Harris's movie. After Harris finally called cut, we learned that the stuntman was saved, it seemed, when the car's rotation was halted upon striking a tree, allowing it to land on its tires, thus accounting for the two crashes we heard. After what seemed like an eternity, the stuntman walked out of the woods under his own power and spent the next couple of hours in the back of an ambulance while we wrapped the set. Just weeks earlier that same year, I worked several night exterior shoots on the Jim Caviezel and Dennis Quaid film, Frequency. In order to get exciting shots of an out-of-control fuel truck jackknifing and eventually exploding under the West Side Highway, The filmmakers decided to put two cameras on two dollies, each with a camera operator and a dolly grip in the middle of the street and in the path of the speeding, jackknifing tractor trailer. The plan was for the camera operators, at the last possible moment as the truck sped toward them, to jump off of the dolly so the dolly grips could push the contraptions laterally out of the way as they ran for their lives from the speeding truck, which would then drive over the roadway where the crew members had been seconds earlier. And that's exactly what they did, twice as I recall. One of the camera operators quit rather than risk his life a second time. On Spider-Man 3, I was about 50 feet in the air with several lights in the basket of an illegally modified aerial lift, and only feet from that production's very sophisticated but not entirely predictable Spider-Cam or Sky-Cam rig. When the Spider-Man stunt double, who was suspended from another aerial lift by a bungee cord of all things, and who was bouncing uncontrolled in every direction, had his thigh sliced open by the Spider-Cam's thin metal eyebrow while man and machine were engaged in a chaotic, unchoreographed sky dance of sorts. We all went home early that night. While filming on the Hudson River in New York City in wind and bitter cold on a ship called the Frying Pan for the Angelina Jolie movie Salt on December 28th and 29th, 2009, word spread among the crew that the hold of the ship where photography was taking place was an asbestos hazard. Lucky for me, I was freezing my butt off on a barge with several ice-covered lights and on an even more ice-covered fireboat moored alongside the Frying Pan movie set. In one of the scenes filmed for Salt in the Frying Pan, air cannons were used in the hold of the ship to disperse material that would create the look of an explosion. The crew members' concern was that the air cannons would also disperse latent asbestos into the air. The solution? After, not before, but after each air cannon explosion, the cast and crew would exit the hold of the ship and wait on the deck for the dust to settle. Literally. After which, actors and crew would descend into the ship again for another take. And that is exactly what they did. You don't have to go to medical school to appreciate the idiocy of that plan if, in fact, there really was asbestos in the ship. Check out the show notes for a link to that scene from Salt on YouTube. In a moment, I'll share one of the most shocking incidents involving an A-list actor that I've witnessed firsthand. But first, after generations of unregulated recklessness in Hollywood, how likely is it that studios, the guilds and unions, or the actors and crew who make motion pictures will demand that on-set safety actually be taken seriously? I think you'll get a pretty good idea if you listen to Directors Guild, Writers Guild, and Screen Actors Guild member Rob Cohen's comments following the death of stuntman Harry O'Connor on the set of Cohen's film Triple X almost 25 years ago.
At the certain point when we do this slide towards the bridge, as I told you before, we did not bring everybody home. Harry O'Connor, our aerial stunt coordinator and stuntman doing this stunt here, now, unfortunately, right there, smacking into the bridge, breaking his neck and dying. This film is dedicated to his memory. I miss him. He was a friend. We had 500 stuntmen involved with this picture. 499 didn't get a scratch. It shows you the lengths to which we'll go to bring this kind of intense experience to the viewer.
It shows you the lengths to which we'll go to bring this kind of intense experience to the viewer. Indeed, Rob Cohen, that's really something to brag about. I could go on for hours with stories of on-set accidents and near accidents that I've seen or heard about from colleagues. But before wrapping up, I want to share just one more terrifying incident that I witnessed firsthand. In the year 2000, we were shooting a stunt for the romantic time travel comedy Kate and Leopold, starring Meg Ryan, Hugh Jackman, and Liev Schreiber.
In 1876, Leopold, Duke of Albany, was a bachelor.
Take a wife.
With few prospects. In 2001, Kate McKay has a successful career.
You're a rarity among women, Kate. You're like a man.
And no life.
One of the so-called studio locations for Kate and Leopold was an abandoned cable factory in Yonkers, New York, in which several sets had been built, including a period replica of part of the Brooklyn Bridge under construction. In a scene which also appears briefly in the film's trailer, Jackman and Schreiber are running at night across a section of the Brooklyn Bridge's construction scaffolding above the East River. The scaffold collapses, Schreiber falls, and Jackman, while supine and clinging to the dangling scaffold platform's railing, grabs Schreiber's hand in an attempt to save him from almost certain death. A moment later, the scaffold gives way and both men plunge into the water. The stunt required that Schreiber wear a harness to which cables were attached that ran upward from the harness 3 or 4 feet to a roughly 2-foot-long bar called, for obvious reasons, a trapeze. I hope this part is easy enough for you to visualize. Wires then ran from the two ends of the trapeze bar upward still further through pulleys fastened to a section of entertainment truss. And the entire contraption was controlled from the ground by the film's local 52 IOTC special effects coordinator. The collapsing scaffold on which Jackman lay at the conclusion of this particular shot was also controlled by the special effects coordinator via a separate cable and pulley rig. The segment we were filming included only the moments before the scaffold failed completely and the men were dumped into the river. So the action for the shot went like this. Schreiber is running across the scaffold. Jackman is pursuing him. The leading edge of the scaffold suddenly collapses. Schreiber begins falling into the abyss. Jackman grabs Schreiber's hand at the last moment and, with his head hanging over the edge of the scaffold, Jackman, aided by Schreiber's trapeze and harness rig, suspends Schreiber above the East River. Easy peasy, right? Sure. We shot the first take. It went well. After calling cut, the first assistant director shouted that everyone should go, quote, back to one, unquote, which is movie lingo for everyone, actors and crew, to return to their starting positions for a particular shot and prepare for another take. And in this case, back to one was also a signal to the special effects coordinator to reset the mechanical scaffold rig by raising it upward. Now, the special effects coordinator was seated at the controls for his rigs below, but not far from, the scaffold on which Jackman was still laying down. But the effects coordinator was seated behind the large base of an aerial lift from which, as I recall, part of the stunt rig was suspended or in which the camera was working. I can't recall. For this reason, the effects coordinator did not have an eye line, more movie lingo, to Jackman and the scaffold rig. The effects coordinator simply couldn't see what was going on. So here's the scene behind the scene. Hugh Jackman is still laying on the scaffold plank. The scaffold plank is inclined downward. Jackman's shoulders, neck, and head are still protruding over the edge of the scaffold, and Liev Schreiber is suspended midair a few feet below Jackman, helpless but safe, in his harness and trapeze rig, and the trapeze bar is several inches above Jackman's head. Got it? I hope so. What happened next? The first assistant director called out, back to one, and the effects coordinator instinctively reset the scaffold rig. The platform on which Jackman was laying and the scaffold snapped upward to level out. As the scaffold plank snapped upward at high speed, Jackman's head and neck were propelled in between the two cables connecting Schreiber's harness to the steel trapeze bar. And the trapeze bar, which was only inches above Jackman, at that moment was transformed from a piece of safety equipment into a hard, dull, stationary guillotine blade ready to break Hugh Jackman's neck or worse. But Jackman, in a feat of instinct and dexterity worthy of James Bond, ducked and pulled his head from between the cables and from beneath the trapeze bar just as the scaffold sped past it. The entire episode began and ended in 2 seconds or less. Hugh Jackman had saved his own life. After which, Jackman, who is among the most gracious men and women with whom I have ever worked, stood up, looked around, and said, nothing. Jackman didn't utter a word to anyone. The only comment on the incident that I heard on set that day was from the first assistant director, who, along with other stunned crew members, had witnessed what was nearly a gruesome tragedy. The first AD looked at the special effects coordinator and said, hey, Connie, maybe you want to set up over here where it'll be easier for you to see what's going on. And scenes like the one I just described, many of which don't conclude with a Hollywood ending, play out day after day on Dream Factory movie and television sets around the world. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Thousands of Tiny Tyrants. If you'd like to contact me with comments or questions, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, you can email me using the contact form on the About page of our website, tinytyrantspodcast.com. Until we meet again, may you, good people of conscience, keep the thousands of tiny tyrants at bay.